I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The five-year civil war in Syria has led to a humanitarian disaster, with millions displaced inside the country and millions who have fled to neighboring countries and parts of Europe. World powers met last week and called for a cessation of hostilities by the end of this week. Meanwhile, the fighting has escalated in and around Aleppo in northern Syria, where the Syrian army, backed by Russian airstrikes and Iranian-backed militias, have been battling rebel forces. And to further complicate matters, Kurdish fighters are trying to gain control of territory near the Turkish border. Today, aid lorries carrying food and medicine are on their way to five besieged towns in Syria desperate for help. We asked Liz Sly to join us. She's Washington Post Beirut bureau chief who has been covering Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and the region. Liz Sly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hello. It's good to be back. Thanks.
Liz, tell us, where are these food trucks going? They have medicine, they have food, they have other supplies for these five towns.
These trucks are most of them going to besieged communities just outside Damascus, the capital. Excuse me. These are areas that were held by the rebels. As the government's pushed rebels back, they've surrounded those towns and people have been trapped inside without food.
Are these trucks safe going to this part of Syria?
Well, one of the big disputes is who is stopping the trucks from going in. The rebels say that whenever trucks try and go, the UN agencies have said that whenever trucks try and go, that they are blocked by the Syrian regime. Basically, there are gunmen on both sides of the line, and you have to have an agreement from both sides for the trucks to be able to travel safely.
That doesn't seem like a confident description about the safety of the trucks.
No, and we've seen trucks being fired on and turned back on many similar occasions when other besieged communities, when there's been attempts to make trucks reach other besieged communities, it does happen that they're fired on if one or other party feels it hasn't been included properly in the deal.
Liz, is there any way for us to understand, I guess, the scale, the misery of the humanitarian crisis that's in Syria? We see images of just completely destroyed either cities or towns or neighborhoods. Is there a way that you can describe what's going on inside Syria today?
Well, yes, it really is quite flabbergasting, the scale of this, and it's very hard to convey. And I think one of the reasons why Syria has not had the attention it deserves is because it's been so hard for journalists to go there. You can't go to the regime areas because they just don't give journalists visas. In the rebel areas, the danger of kidnapped by extremists such as Islamic State is so high that journalists have stopped going there. And so there's this huge humanitarian catastrophe unfolding outside the eyes of the world. You've got these besieged communities. Conditions are very acute inside them. There's not that many people living in these areas, but so many people have fled. As you know, there's been like 4 to 5 million Syrians have fled the country altogether. A lot of them have gone to Europe. You've got about 7 or 8 million people displaced inside Syria. They've moved from unsafe areas to safer areas. The people left behind in their communities tend to be the poorest and most vulnerable, often the elderly who don't like to leave their homes, or poor people who just can't even afford the transportation to get away from the fighting. And after many, many months under siege, a lot of people are actually on the brink of starvation. It's very, very acute. But even in the other communities where people aren't actually under siege, everybody is suffering from airstrikes. We forget that these, you know, daily airstrikes against people are killing and maiming people every day in horrible ways. And there isn't much access to medical supplies, to hospitals. The hospitals have been deliberately targeted and bombed. And there are communities that don't have hospitals to treat people injured in this fighting. So it's really very horrible.
And I do want to talk about some of the bombing. You mentioned safe areas in Syria. Where would a Syrian go to find safety in that country?
Well, there's a big number of refugees, displaced people, I should say, are not actually refugees. In, for example, the capital, Damascus, people, the suburbs have been a war zone for most of the past 5 years. A lot of people have left the suburbs and gone and lived in Damascus, the capital, which is one of the only safe places. And actually, I think it's probably about the only safe place. There are also some places in Homs, Hama, and on the west coast, Latakia and Tartus, that have not had a lot of fighting, and they have put a lot of people in them as well who do not come from those areas, but they've gone there, rented accommodation, or stayed with friends and relatives.
And why?
They camp sometimes there too.
And why Aleppo? I know this has been a rebel stronghold, and when you talk about the bombing, is this bombing by the Russians?
Yes, from what we can gather, according to eyewitnesses and the military analysts who've studied all the videos and everything, these days, since the Russian intervention, the bombing in the north of Syria is almost entirely by Russian aircraft. Syrian government planes are bombing still, but they're mostly bombing around Damascus and in the south of the country.
We hear stories of hospitals and schools that have bombed. Are the Russians the country that are doing this?
Well, the aid agencies and the UN have compiled evidence that suggests that hospitals and medical facilities are being deliberately targeted. They blame the Syrian government and its allies, which means the Russians. They're the only two powers with aircraft in this part of Syria operating. The military experts tell us it's Russian planes doing the bombing in the north of Syria, so it does look like Russia has been deliberately bombing medical facilities and also bakeries.
Is that not a war crime?
Well, that's what people say. I mean, there are many allegations of that. There are many aid agencies out there crying that this is a crime, but Russia denies it. Russia always says it was the Americans that did it.
And looking at this bombing campaign, especially in and around Aleppo, are the targets the rebels? And I do want to talk about ISIS because, of course, this is such a complicated part of the world and certainly a very complicated conflict. But who are the Russians and, I guess, the Syrian government? Who are their targets?
Well, you've got two different wars going on in Syria right now. You've got one war which is essentially a civil war being fought in the northwest, center, and south of the country between the rebels who rose up and tried to topple Assad in 2011 and are now being beaten back. You've got a separate war going on in the east of the country between the Islamic State, which emerged out of the vacuum created by the challenge to the authority of the government and took over a large chunk of the territory of the east of the country. That war is going on mostly from the air between with American bombing and Russian bombing, but mostly more of it is American bombing against the Islamic State to get the Islamic State out of those areas. So you've got those two different wars going on.
You had a piece recently in the Washington Post where you talked about a mini world war that's taking place in Syria. I mean, certainly there are, as you mentioned, so many different players, a mini world war.
Well, yes, what you've got, especially in the area around Aleppo right now, you've got a narrow strip of territory that is extremely strategic for whoever controls it. It controls a neck of territory between the city of Aleppo and the Turkish border. That area has been in the hands of the rebels for the past 4 years. The Russians have targeted their airstrikes very much against rebels in that area in an obvious bid to try and take that area and cut the rebels in the city of Aleppo off from their supply routes to the Turkish border. For ground forces, they are using Iranian-backed militias, the same militias that we see fighting in Iraq right now, and Lebanese Hezbollah, who've been fighting in other parts of the country, but have now moved up to take a prominent role in the Aleppo offensive. And they're being led by Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps advisors and generals. There's been a number of them killed. So you've got a sort of little melange of world competition taking place over this very small area. Then more recently, as you mentioned in the introduction, the Kurds have been trying to move into that area too, and now the Turks are all upset about that, and they've started bombing the Kurds. So you've got a multitude of different regional conflicts sort of playing out in this very small space of territory.
Raising questions about whether this ceasefire that some of these world powers, world leaders have called on, what do you think, Liz, the chance of that holding is?
Well, there hasn't been a ceasefire yet, and I don't think it looks like there's going to be one. Assad has said he doesn't want a ceasefire. He's implied that a ceasefire means one side keeps shooting so that the other side stops its fire. That was how he kind of defined it. The Russians have said they want to continue to be able to bomb all the terrorists, and they've also made it clear that they regard everybody who's taken up arms against Assad as a terrorist, so they're going to continue shooting. The rebels are certainly not going to stop shooting if nobody else stops shooting, and the Kurds weren't a party to this, so I don't think we're going to see any ceasefire anytime soon.
Are we witnessing the end of Syria, the destruction of a country?
Well, I think it's pretty far gone already. You've got huge areas that are just completely obliterated, whole neighborhoods that are just crushed, pulverized rubble and empty already. There's not much of it left to save, but yes, it's a huge catastrophe.
And President Assad, do you think he's felt emboldened by the involvement of Russia and its air force?
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, there was a speech he gave last July in which he acknowledged to his people that he was going to have to let go of some areas because he didn't have the manpower to keep them. And that speech was really quite a turning point. I think it alarmed the Russians enough to realize that they would have to intervene, and it was from that point on that they started planning the intervention. And in his most recent comments in the past few days, an interview last week and in a speech earlier this week, he said his goal now is to get the whole country back, and a lot of people did think that Assad would never be able to get the whole country back. People were talking about a solution of perhaps giving a bit to the rebels and Assad taking a bit or something like that. He says no, he's going to get the whole country back.
Hmm. How do you get new? As you say, you're joining us from Beirut, and you described how difficult it is for reporters to get inside that country. How do you get the news from Syria, Liz?
I'm actually in Turkey at the moment. I've been down on the border talking to people there about what's been going on in this Aleppo Northern Corridor area. I'm just back from there. You can talk to people. You establish a network of contacts with people inside who you can speak to and tell you what's going on. You learn who you can trust and who you can't trust. But it's extremely difficult to convey. You can explain what is happening, but you can't convey adequately how it's happening and the sheer human misery of it.
If you're in Turkey, and clearly you are, if you go to the border, can you see the fighting?
No, you can't. It's sealed off. You can hear the bombing. You can hear the rumble of the airstrikes from the distance. But the Turks have sealed the border completely. You can't see anything that's going on the other side. There are tens of thousands of refugees stacked up on the other side wanting to come across. Turkey isn't letting them across. It's pretty much sealed there.
Well, Liz, I really appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Stay safe as well.
Thank you.
And Liz Sly, Washington Post bureau chief, who has been covering Syria. She also covers Lebanon, Iraq, and the region. Getting us started as we're talking about the fighting in Syria, the humanitarian crisis as a result of that fighting in Syria. And we have two guests who are waiting in the wings, will be joining us after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We just got an update on what's been happening in Syria from Liz Sly. She's Washington Post bureau chief based in Beirut. Now we want to refocus our conversation talking about the United States. Should the U.S. intervene in Syria? If yes, how? And should it do more to stop the humanitarian crisis? We have two guests who have joined us. Jonathan Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment. That's a blog on Syrian politics, history, and religion. Jonathan Landis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Also with us is Ambassador James Jeffrey. He's the Philip Solons Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute. Previously served as U.S. ambassador to both Turkey and Iraq in the Obama administration. And Ambassador Jeffrey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Ambassador Jeffrey, just talking about what I was talking with Liz Sly about, her description of what's going on in Syria as a mini world war. Do you think that's an apt description?
Yes.
Yes?
Exactly.
Because we've got, so many players. I mean, sometimes it's called a proxy war, but this is a mini world war.
It's a mini world war in two senses. One is rather like the situation in the Balkans 20 years ago. almost you have many different players directly or indirectly involved. Turkey, the Gulf states, Jordan, Syria, Iran, Russia, the United States, and over the horizon, the European Union, our NATO allies, because of the impact of the refugee flows on their stability and their role in the fight against ISIS. So in that sense, it's a world war because so many are involved. It's not really a proxy war because only one side is actually fighting a proxy war, and that's Russia, Iran, and Syria. The United States is sort of clueless, this administration, as to what its real policy in Syria should be.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me go to you, Joshua Landis, and I'm looking at a chart that Charles Lister put together. We actually posted it on our Facebook page, just describing all the players in Syria. We've got the Syrian opposition, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Syrian army, the National Defense Force, Hezbollah, Shia militias, Russia, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, YPG, Syrian Democratic Forces, U.S. Air Force, U.S.-led ISIS coalition, Turkey and Israeli Air Force, all having a role that they're playing in this beleaguered country. What do we make of that?
Well, absolutely. And this, unfortunately, Syria, in a sense, the United States stumbled into Syria. Syria has never been important to the United States, which I think is very, you know, at the foundation of this discussion. Is important to understand. The United States has spent about $5 billion on Syria outside of the war on ISIS in the last 5 years, which is the equivalent to less than 1 month of spending in Iraq at the height of our occupation there. The United States has never had good relations with Syria. Ever since Syria went to war against Israel in 1948, we've had terrible relations. Syria went into the orbit of the Soviet Union as a result and has stayed in Russia's orbit ever since. And so the idea that the United States, that President Obama is going to try to pull Syria out of Russia's orbit, fire up the Mujahideen and the various fighters, militias in Syria, try to unify them, which he did to a certain degree, but he stumbled. And that's really the, you know, the debate here is, should the United States get into Syria much more seriously, spend, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars or tens of billions of dollars in order to frustrate the Russians and come up with a better plan for solving the Syria problem, or should it cede Syria to the Russians? And President Obama has, by and large, decided that we cannot win this war and better to cede it to the Russians today.
Is that something you think is a smart and rightful policy?
I do. Today, I think that Syria is so crushed, in part because we fought this proxy war against Assad and the Russians only halfway. We haven't wanted to go in all the way and win and do an Iraq where we occupy and rebuild the state, which would have been the right thing to do if you want to intervene. Mm. But we haven't stepped aside either. We've organized the opposition. We've overseen the spending of billions of dollars by both Qatar, the Saudis, Turks, and others in order to fight Assad without a conclusion. And this has kept Syria in a terrible civil war for 5 years, which has made the population flee and destroyed the country. In a sense, if we're not going to win, we should be able to step aside and let the Russians finish the civil war, because it's the civil war that's driving it now. And the longer it goes on, the worse it is. In some ways, even though the solution of letting Assad and the Russians win is not a good one for the United States, it's better than continuing to fight a war we do not mean to win.
Ambassador Jeffrey, let me go back to you, and I'm sure you want to respond to what Jonathan Landis just said, but let me just quote something that the president said yesterday at his press conference. He said, the question is, how can we stop the suffering, stabilize the region, stop this massive out-migration of refugees who are having such a terrible time, end the violence, stop the bombing of schools and hospitals and innocent civilians, stop creating safe havens for ISIS? Is that something the United States can do?
The United States could do more. But many of the considerations that Professor Landis raised have to be weighed. I'm an advocate for the United States doing more. Here's why. First of all, and I'm putting words in the professor's mouth, but if you connect his dots, he's basically saying this war has gone on because of America from the outside. No, this is a war between the Assad regime and some of the groups in Syria and much of the population, certainly much of the Sunni Arab population. And the reason that they've risen up is the same reason that people have risen up in other countries, the terrible nature of that government. The problem is that that government then, encouraged by the Iranians and to some degree the Russians, decided rather than to try to negotiate or to achieve some kind of military balance and then see if they could find a way out, as most conflicts resolve around the world, it decided that it would slaughter the population until the resistance just caved. We called this 30 years ago Hama rules for the city in Syria that was held by the Muslim Brothers, that Assad's father, Bashar al-Assad, basically, or I'm sorry, Hafiz al-Assad, basically leveled. And we've seen this in Chechnya with the Russians. And the problem is that much of the Middle East, including our allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other Gulf states, are not going to stand by and watch what they see, not just as the slaughter of Sunnis by Assad. That would be difficult enough, but rather the amassing of power by Iran, allied with Assad, Lebanese Hezbollah, and now Russia. This to them is an existential threat, and they're right. So while the situation is very messy, there's a role for us in trying to not overthrow Assad or to pull Assad out of the Russian camp or get rid of the Russian base, but to work for some kind of military stalemate that can then actually make these negotiated agreements that the Russians keep signing up to and then violating actually take effect. That's the only way out.
How do you create a military stalemate? I'm actually looking at a piece that you and Nicholas Burns had in the Washington Post, the diplomatic case for America to create a safe zone in Syria. But how do you stop the fighting?
Again, it's not a question of stopping the fighting. It's a question of ensuring that everybody understands that nobody's going to win. Right now, while the two mouthpieces of the West, Secretary Kerry and German Foreign Minister Steinmeier, miss no opportunity to say there's no military solution to Syria. Certainly there's no German or American one right now. The Russians are clearly stating there is a military solution. We're just going to bomb like we did in Chechnya until these people are all dead or they fled to Europe, thus destabilizing Europe. You get two for the price of one. And we'll be the last people sitting on top of this ash heap and graveyard that will be called Syria. That's their policy. What you do to balance that is, first of all, provide more support to the rebels, particularly the rebels who we can halfway trust, and our support has been anemic over the years. Professor Landis said, these Qataris and the Saudis and others have given more. Secondly, take some kind of a role in the north, because otherwise we are risking a Turkish-Russian conflict, and that would bring in NATO. So there's an immediate American security interest in calming things down in that area. And to the argument, well, would the Russians engage with us? Nothing, you can't rule anything out, but it's less likely that the Russians would engage with us than the Russians would stumble into a conflict with the Turks, because neither side are really totally trustworthy.
Well, let me give you a chance, Joshua Lennis, to respond to what the ambassador offered as a way to at least tamp down some of the fighting and violence in Syria.
Well, let me respond in two ways. You know, one is that I don't think this is a realistic plan for winning in Syria, but more importantly, I'm sitting here in Oklahoma. We've just gotten news that our state budget is 20%, running a 20% deficit. We've already cut education in Oklahoma further than any other state over the last, since the recession in 2008. People are talking about a four-day school week. The point I'm making is there are cost benefits to us keeping control of the Middle East and trying to push Russia out. We've spent over $3 trillion in Iraq and $1 trillion more in Afghanistan. That's a tremendous amount of money, and it's been badly misspent. Our attempts to bring about regime change, both in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen, and now in Syria, are disastrous. They've brought destruction of the states in the Middle East, and they've created a playground in which extremists expand, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And today, the government of Iraq, with American air power, is getting its feet back on the ground and beginning to destroy ISIS. The Assad government, a sectarian government, just like the one in Iraq, is also being rebuilt by the Russians, and it's pounding both Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Mm-hmm. For the United States to step in and say, we're not going to let you do it, we're going to create no-fly zones, essentially means we're going to divide Syria in half. Assad gets to keep the good half on the west, and America will keep the east, where ISIS is, and some area in the north or wherever the no-fly zone is that the ambassador wants to create, and will not only win it for the rebels, have to unite the rebels. There are 1,500 different rebel groups. They're organized according to tribe, clan, and family, village, and unify them and make the moderates win, destroying all the Al-Qaeda and jihadists and Salafists, will be in charge of a country that we don't want to be in charge of. And we can't – we've been very bad at being in charge of these governments in the past. So I just don't see where it is in America's interests. What is America going to get out of this except for throwing tons of money at a problem that we cannot adjudicate?
So you're saying, Joshua, the U.S. just – I don't mean just, we'll stand on the sidelines and let whoever in Syria, let them fight it out and, in a sense, see who wins?
Well, Assad, you know, if the Russians, if America stands aside today, it looks like Russia and Assad will win. And that's what we did, I guess, with Poland and all of Eastern Europe after World War II. It's a terrible thing to do, but the alternative is even worse. And that's the... that's the argument, is that keeping the civil war going by feeding proxy armies without any plan for a solution. America has done that for the last 5 years. And where has it gotten us? It's gotten us a country that's completely destroyed. In Iran in 2009, when the Green Revolution started, America talked about jumping in, but we didn't. The Iranian government destroyed that revolution. If it's a bad thing. But it's been stable ever since. And I think it would have been a mistake for America to have jumped in on the side of the Green Revolutionaries and tried to overthrow the government and brought Iran into a civil war.
Ambassador Jeffrey, I do want to talk about the role that Russia is playing in Syria, obviously on the side of the Assad government. And they don't seem to be particularly concerned about hitting civilians, hitting hospitals, hitting schools. How does the U.S. or anyone that the U.S. allies itself with, how do you fight someone like that or prevent something like that when they don't seem to have the same kind of concerns about civilian casualties that the U.S. and other countries have?
I would put the question differently. If you're dealing with, and this gets to at least part of my disagreement with Professor Landis, if you're dealing with people who act like that, you have a responsibility, you have a very serious responsibility to try to stop them because they are playing with different rules. And here we have mixing of oranges and apples. To compare the Assad government with the Abadi government in Iraq is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard. The Abadi government could be more inclusive, but it deals all of the time with a parliament of Sunni Arabs and Kurds, as well as Shia Arabs, and it does not have a rebellion in its midst. It has ISIS occupying territory, but much of the Sunni Arab population has fled to Shia and Kurdish areas. They've marched with their feet, not away. Nobody is, or very few people are moving into the Assad areas of Syria. They're moving to Europe. They're moving to Turkey. There's a huge difference here. But the other thing is, I have the very same sympathies that Professor Landis has about getting involved in civil wars in the Middle East or the Balkans or elsewhere. What makes the difference for me is not people killing themselves. I would have never engaged, for example, in Libya. It is the involvement of Iran and Russia, particularly Russia, but Iran was pretty serious too, in the larger plan that these countries have to establish a different security order in the Middle East. This is a big thing. And this is a very threatening thing. Finally, I'm still wiping tears from my eyes about the people in Oklahoma who will have to do without their milk money because of, you know, our wasting trillions, in the Middle East. Aside from the fact I disagree with his figures on Iraq, I mean, we did spend certainly over $1 trillion there. But my point is, that's not what we're talking about here. There are really good arguments. I won't make them because I'm on the other side, but there are really good arguments for us not getting engaged in Syria. Professor Landis didn't make them because it's so much easier to simply wave the flag of Iraq, trillions of dollars and everything else. My question to Professor Landis is, how much money is Putin spending for his decisive military operation? He's got 30 airplanes and maybe 1,500 to 2,000 troops. That doesn't sound like trillions of dollars. That doesn't sound like a quagmire, which is what President Obama predicted. That sounds like a military victory on the cheap. That's what we have done for 70 years around the world. A couple of times we screwed up, Vietnam one, Iraq a second, but most of the time we've been able to do it without making the kids in Oklahoma have to go to school only 3 days a week. Thank you.
Don't go away, but only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are getting two very fascinating, interesting, and different descriptions and prescriptions about what's going on in Syria. The voice you just heard, Ambassador James Jeffrey. He's the Philip Solons Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute. He served as U.S. Ambassador to both Turkey and Iraq in the Obama administration. Joshua Landis joining us as well, Director of the Center for Middle East Studies and Associate Professor at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, that's a blog on Syrian politics, history, and religion. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And Joshua, we'll toss that question to you after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jim Jeffrey and Joshua Landis about the war, the civil war. Some are calling it a mini world war in Syria. That has been raging for about 5 years. Something like half of the population of that country is homeless, either inside or outside of the country. The refugee crisis called one of the worst since World War II. World leaders have been meeting to try to end the hostilities. Meanwhile, there's an increased bombing campaign in and around the city of Aleppo. 1-888-477-9499. What do you think the U.S. should do when it comes to Syria? Joshua Landis, picking up on what Jim Jeffrey said right before the break, and there is a question about why Russia seems to have been more successful, if I can put it that way, in Syria than the United States, which has been doing drone strikes and also supporting some of the rebel groups. Syria looks like it's, or certainly Aleppo looks like it could fall to Russians and to the Assad government.
Yes, it does. Let me take on this question of the threat of Russia. And if we compare Syria to Afghanistan in 1979, Russia invaded Afghanistan at the bequest of a jumped up government. We took them on, giving Stinger missiles and funding the Mujahideen and inviting Arab fighters to go and fight this Islamic war against the godless Russians. So we fired up Muslim extremists in order to take down Russia. We thought we were very smart because we were doing it on the cheap and we were cunning. But what did it give us? By shoving the Russians out of Afghanistan, we got 9/11, we built Al-Qaeda, and we ended up with the Taliban. We had to invade Afghanistan in order to undo what we had largely created ourselves. And then we invaded Iraq as a subset of this and spent trillions of dollars, created havoc through the Middle East. And now the question is, are we to do that again in Syria? If we take on the Russians in Syria, we're going to be supporting the Muslim militias, the Sunni Muslim militias. The two strongest militias there are Al-Qaeda and ISIS. That's the product of having broken down the central government. If we destroy Assad, we will have a country like Libya that is broken down by village and clan and tribe with over 1,000 militias and a playground for extremism. And the ambassador, I think, has made a mistake here in saying that most refugees flee out of away from Assad. That's not true. Many refugees have gone to Damascus, Tartus on the coast, all the coastal cities. In fact, about 75% of the Syrian Sunni Arabs live under government control today because it's the one safe place to be, because schools still run, your retirement salaries are still given, there's still some electricity and so forth. It is havoc on the other side of rebel lines. Wherever the rebels have taken over, all the Christians have been chased out. The Druze, Ismailis, all the religious minorities. Why? Because the rebels are quite extremist, and they have chased out all the minorities. So this is not the heaven. By supporting these rebels, America is only sowing more problems for itself, in the same way it did by overturning the government in Iraq and invading Afghanistan.
Ambassador, let me go back to you and picking up on something that Joshua Landis said about Assad. In your calculations for Syria, what role do you see Assad playing, or should he be asked to leave or live in another country or live in Russia? What do you see as the future of Assad?
You have to separate Assad from the Syrian state, although that isn't easy because Assad's clan of the Alawites does control many of the levers of true state power. Assad is considered by most of the population of Syria to be the guy who ordered the killing of, the UN stopped counting at about 250,000, but many sources put it as high as 460,000 of his fellow citizens. I don't think there's a future for him. I don't think the countries of the region, other than Iran, think that there's a future for him either. I think that this fighting is going to continue with or without the United States, with or without a military victory in the north by Russian bombs, if Assad is maintained in power. There are solutions. The UN has a whole plan. That plan has been endorsed by the Group of 17, the Iraq, the International Syria Support Group. And there is a way forward to do this. Will it be easy? Well, sure. This is going to be difficult. The problem is you have to weigh against it what's going to happen with a continuing civil war and Iran and Russia increasingly dominating the region and pushing up against Turkey, Israel, and the Gulf states. This is an extraordinarily dangerous movement, and it goes far beyond Syria. Just like our intervention in Afghanistan in 1979 went far beyond what happened to that very unfortunate country. It was all about Soviet aggression worldwide, and we won, and we did a massive job taking down the Soviet Union. It was worth the effort.
Well, let me ask you, when you, Ambassador, talk about U.S. More U.S. military involvement in Syria, do you anticipate or imagine ground troops in that country?
In the sense of a few hundred or a few thousand in this safe zone, and this isn't an occupation of the country, it's occupying an area that is right now mainly populated by people who are in opposition to Assad and thus presumably are supportive of us. And we'd have to do it with the Turks and with other people. So it would be a commitment, but it wouldn't be a large one.
And the idea of creating a safe zone, obviously to keep the population safer than it is. And Joshua Landis, I hear what you're saying. How, though, do you wrestle with the humanitarian crisis in Syria, the fact that so many people, I mean millions of people, have been displaced by the fighting? They're suffering, some of them, in refugee camps within the country, outside of the country. How do you deal with that? And what should, does the U.S. have an obligation for people who are refugees under these circumstances?
Absolutely. The entire international community has an obligation. But you can't fight a proxy war and expect there not to be human damage. If you're going to do it, what, you know, on the human side, if you want to intervene and destroy the government of Syria because you think it's a bad government, then it's incumbent upon you to send an international peacekeeping force, occupy the country, take guns away from everybody, and keep people safe. You can't just throw guns in and money in to a bunch of rebel groups, many of whom are quite Islamist, and execute all their prisoners just the way Assad is executing prisoners, and expect not to have human damage. We have stoked this war along with our allies, and we have not won it. Either you win it and you try to bring security to the country, or you don't. You step aside. The worst thing is what's happened, which is not to win it, not to have an idea of what you want, just to make sure that the other side can't win. Because then you condemn the country to years and years of destruction, which is what we've done. And I think that is the most irresponsible thing. That's why I suggest, because I cannot see how America's going to win this. And a no-fly zone with just a few hundred American soldiers to police it is lunacy. Nusra, the al-Qaeda branch, is a dominant part of the Jaish al-Fatah, this big umbrella group that rules Idlib province and northern Syria. If America were to create a no-fly zone over part of that area or even most of that area, it would have to send tons of troops down there in order to kill all the extremists that we consider terrorists, help the moderates police it, and then we would have to unite them. This would not be easy. To distribute aid money that it wouldn't go through militias that we don't like would require us, in a sense, building a new state in part of Syria. That would only be the beginning, because once we've done that, we would have to make sure that that state can defend itself, and there would be tons of effort to try to expand that state over all of Syria. So a no-fly zone is an opening gambit in a much bigger game that needs a resolution to the Syrian crisis. And I haven't heard that from the ambassador. How does this resolve itself? Does he want to just divide the country in two where America owns half? Or does he want to conquer the entire country, set up a liberal government, and have America adjudicate that?
Well, let's find out, and then I do want to get to some callers. Ambassador Jeffrey, go ahead.
Naida, the whole point is to ensure that there is a ceasefire that can be held. The ceasefire will not occur if Assad and his supporters believe they can achieve a military victory. The idea of a no-fly zone and giving better arms and more arms and more efficient delivery of arms to rebels is not to overthrow the Assad government, is not to create a liberal democracy, because you can't do that. It is simply to affect a better balance between the two and a military stalemate. The ability of Russia and Iran to engage at ever higher costs, they're both dependent upon oil exports, which aren't doing well right now, in Syria, is somewhat limited. If they can achieve their minimum goals, which is a Syrian state that does not dissolve, and there I'm exactly in the same place as Professor Landis, the preservation of the Iranian privileged position and supply lines to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and the preservation of Russia's base up by Latakia, then I think that if they look at the alternatives that are unpleasant, they might put pressure on Assad to step aside and to negotiate again along the lines of these plans that the UN has been putting together for years now. That's the only alternative to, again, the continuation of this civil war with or without the United States, with soon not 460, but a million casualties, and possibly two or three times this many refugees, most of whom don't flee to the Assad's area, I'm sorry. And secondly, military dominance of the region by Iran and Russia. And those are all really very bad outcomes.
Let me get some callers, and we've got Rick calling us from Warminster. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. It's not a one-size-fits-all, but I would refer back to the Dayton Accords. And our particular company, which was consisted of retired military officers and NCOs, 200 of us went to Sarajevo and Livno and Pazaric and met with the Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And we had three entities, the Serbs, the Croats, and the Bosniaks. And after Milosevic's demise, not a shot's been fired in anger. So it's not always boots on the ground with millions and millions of dollars. There are models out there, and I think the ambassador would say that this was not a bad model from 1996 to 2000.
Rick, that's a really interesting comment. Actually, let me toss that first to you, Joshua Landis. Are there some lessons from some of these other peace accords that obviously more successful than what we're seeing in Syria so far?
Well, Yugoslavia was, you know, is an interesting model because there is a country that was full of people who did not want to live together, ruled over by a little sultan, in a sense, by Tito. And as soon as he left, the country burst into war. It is now seven nation states, if you will. And it's been the peace has been kept by an international peacekeeping force and by intervention. That is a possibility for Syria, as it is for Iraq. You could break the country up in so that there would be an Alawite enclave, there would be a Kurdish enclave in the north, and the Sunnis would dominate the center, there would be Druze. You could do that, and it might be a good solution, but it would require an international peacekeeping force of the kind that our caller was involved in mm-hmm. to – and a major international effort, which is not going to happen. And that's the problem. If it's not going to happen, how do you – you know, what do you do?
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to put that to you, Ambassador Jeffrey. What do you think?
I really like the idea of your caller. I work with groups like MPI. I was the deputy coordinator for implementing the Dayton Accords. It is one of the models I look to in turning to Syria and, unfortunately, Iraq, but we didn't do it. We did have to put boots on the ground there. We put 20,000 American troops into Bosnia in 1995. Number of casualties, zero. Now, you can't promise that in the Middle East. My point is, it is a Western NATO alliance that is far richer now than it was 20 years ago, clearly with regional powers, could work a deal with the Russians and come up with a solution to Syria. Unlike Iraq in 2003, Syria is seen as a major threat to almost the entire Eurasian landmass. Certainly Europe, certainly the United States, certainly people in the region, even Russia, to the extent you can give them positive motives. And thus, there should be the ability to resolve this thing along the lines that we did the Balkans. Every argument I heard Professor Landis make, and they're not invalid arguments, I heard from 1992 to 1995 on Bosnia. And then suddenly an American president and Dick Holbrooke acted, and suddenly those arguments and those complications and those tribes and those many groups fighting each other all melted away, and we got a peace that has held for, other than the Kosovo war in 1999, for 20 years.
Well, would that that would happen in Syria. One can only hope, and so much more to talk about. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ambassador Jeffrey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And James Jeffrey, the Philip Solons Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute. Joshua Landis, thank you very much as well.
Pleasure. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Director of the Center for Middle East Studies and Associate Professor at the University of Oklahoma. He writes the Syria Comment, and that's a blog on Syrian politics, history, and religion. We began our conversation with Liz Sly, joining us from Turkey, Washington Post Beirut Bureau Chief. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.